Trying to grab the wind is impossible, but Bill Strever has certainly captured the essence of understanding why air moves and what it means when it does so. Through examinations of the early science behind meteorology and predictions that weather forecasting would be simple mathematics, to the dawning realization that variability means we can't reliably predict the weather out very far because the wind will do what the wind will do. Strever's new book, And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind, is a fascinating narrative about the search for understanding moving air. Alaska author Bill Strever is our guest today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. If you want to realize how important the wind is, buy a sailboat and take off. That's what our guest Bill Strever and his wife Lisanna did. The idea of writing a book on wind has been on Mr. Strever's mind for quite some time. So a sailing trip across the Gulf of Mexico was the perfect setting for building their personal connection to being propelled forward by pleasant Goldilocks winds and for understanding the fear that can come from being at the mercy of a big blow that is indifferent to what can happen to humans bobbing on ocean waves far from shore. Bill, Lisanna, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Well, thanks, Lori.
Yeah, thanks so much for both of you coming in today. Bill, if you hadn't already written two stellar pieces of work, science and history examinations of what are big and complex issues, cold and your second book, Heat, I would sort of have been doubtful about your taking on what seems impossibly elusive, trying to capture the essence of wind. But wow, I'm going to try to not sound too fan obsessed here, but this is an amazing book. I'm only halfway through it because I'm trying really hard to absorb. I'm going to have to read it again because there's so much going on. But at the same time, you've done such an amazing job of stuffing in so much history and by so many different perspectives into a really compelling narrative that's really easy to absorb at the same time. It's kind of fascinating. When we talked the other day, you said you've been contemplating this book on wind for quite some time. When you started the actual work, how did you go about tracking down all the incredible connections really across the planet of the history of humans trying to understand, predict, and harness that most powerful and yet invisible force, wind?
Well, first of all, I really like it when you sound fan-obsessed. You've made my day already, so thank you. So how did I go about trying to understand the wind, I think, is really what you're asking. And it, you know, probably when I started this book, if I'd have realized how big of a subject it is when I began the book, I don't know that I would have proposed it, but I proposed the book, and then as I got further into the research and realized how complicated it was, I was like, oh no, how am I going to do this? And went through, my writing process for these nonfiction books involves very complicated sort of three-dimensional fluid outlines. So I start out with a written outline, but it changes all the time. It's on a computer, so I can change it as I go. And then as I learn new things, the jigsaw puzzle starts to come together. And if one of the pieces doesn't quite fit in one place, I'll move it, just like you would if you were building a jigsaw puzzle, maybe. You've got a force fit somewhere that doesn't work, so you move it and you go somewhere else. And in the book, and in the experience of writing the book, you'll see that I jump around a lot in time. And you almost have to understand wind and weather forecasting and to bring the different players together. And there were lots of players. So there were players involved in the science of forecasting. And that's a whole huge cast of characters. And I think most people have a very, very poor appreciation of how weather is forecast today and even less of an appreciation of how recently that's all come about and of how many different people from different nations and different cultures have contributed to that. But that's only part of it. So you've also got a whole huge history, a tremendous history of sailing and of transporting goods across the planet under sail, explorers working under sail, shipwrecks, terrible storms that affected not only sailors but also farmers, everyday people, just as storms do today, but at a time when there were no storm warnings, there was no communication, there was no organized disaster relief and that sort of thing. And then on top of that, you have biologists. You have landscapes being formed by wind. You have wind and its impact on wars. World War II, a huge impact of wind. Vietnam War, some weather experimentation going on during the Vietnam conflict where the U.S. government was experimenting with weather control. So these stories, you know, they go on and on and on, and the book could have been five times longer without running out of weather stories. And maybe today, as people call in, we might be lucky enough to hear some interesting Alaskan weather stories.
And if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and my guests today are author Bill Strever and his co-captain and wife, Lisanna, is also in the studio with us. We're going to be talking about their trip across the Gulf of Mexico and all things wind today as we explore And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind, Bill Strever's latest book. You can join our conversation if you're a sailor or a commercial fisherman or just someone who wonders about the wind or is bugged by the wind. You can call us statewide, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So learning is always enhanced by practical application. You can read all the cookbooks you want, but until you cook and work with food in a kitchen, you can't really know cooking. How has sailing enhanced and changed your understanding of moving air? And Lisanna, I'm sure that, you know, there was some realizations for you as well in this process as you guys undertook this adventure on your sailboat.
Well, for sure. You can be awfully self-confident and cocky about the wind when you're learning from books, when you're reading about it, when you're taking a course in it. But then get out on a sailboat, especially as novice sailors, which we were. We bought this boat, and we really had very little sailing experience, and we did a three-day course down in Seward. We bought the boat in Galveston, Texas, close to Houston. And we said, you know, it's time to go. We looked around us, and there were all kinds of people more or less permanently tied to the dock talking about their dreams of taking their boat somewhere. And we didn't want to be one of those guys that was permanently tied to the dock. So off we went, but we were woefully ill-prepared, although we had a great library on board.
well, that's always helpful.
In principle, we knew all there was to know, but in fact, we knew almost nothing. And I'll turn over to my co-captain. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you captured that right well, Bill. For me, and still is, actually, the wind is one of the most scary part of sailing. Sounds counterintuitive because sailing is all about, you know, working with the wind. But because partly you never know what it's going to do. And even if you have weather predictions, you not always know whether they're right or wrong or if they apply to that little part of the world or little part of the ocean that you're on. So, yeah, the books are very useful, but not always helpful out on the ocean.
I think that it's important to have a healthy concern about the wind because you can be so helpless. We were talking the other day about the windstorm here in Anchorage of 2012, and I remember that night when the power went out and the wind was getting worse and worse and worse, and I had a 60-foot spruce tree in my backyard just go completely over into the neighbor's yard, and I wondered if the house would hold together. And I thought, this must be what it's like to sit through a hurricane and wonder, as your house is vibrating, if you're going to make it and your house is going to make it, and how helpless you really are. There's nothing you can do against this force.
It often feels like that. And in hurricane strength winds at sea, I think it's probably reasonably accurate that there's almost nothing you can do except hunker down. And there are some storm management tricks that you would try that mostly involve avoidance of the storm. But once you're in the thick of true hurricane force winds on a small sailboat, you're pretty much batten down waiting for the storm to pass. But, you know, one thing that's really different today, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, it's really different than the distant past of a little more than 100 years ago, but even different from the 1970s or 80s or even 90s is the quality of the forecasts, especially for offshore. Once you're offshore, you're on the ocean, so there's not a lot of nuances caused by land masses that are funneling wind or tripping wind and that kind of thing. So once you're on the open ocean, the wind forecasts are way, way more accurate than they were just 20 or 30 years ago. And if you go even further back than that to the middle of the 1800s, the height of the age of sail, people sailed in the total absence of forecasts. There were no forecasts. So they set sail. If they set a particular day, they would look at what the wind was doing that day to see if it could get them out of the harbor. They would time their departures often on the tide, you know, we'll sail with the tide kind of thing. But they didn't have weather forecasts. Today, there's very few cruising sailors that would not watch the forecast very closely before setting out on their trip. And the first 3 or so days of the forecast are quite reliable nowadays. Going out further than 3 days and into a week and 2 weeks, much less reliable. But you can also get updates while you're offshore. Mm. And one thing that's fascinated me in our travels on our boat is meeting lots and lots of different kinds of people and lots of characters, including several characters that still today, and gee, go figure, these are single male sailors. They're single-handers. But they're very proud of the fact that they don't check forecasts. Oh, I just go. I just go when I'm ready to go. I just go. My boat can handle anything. And, of course, it's no boat can handle anything. That's
no.
A ridiculous statement. But that is what these guys say. One guy who I really enjoyed talking to, he was telling me this, and he was tied to a dock in, I think it was in Guatemala or it might have been Honduras, but he's tied to the dock and had been tied to the dock for quite some time. And he's telling me how when I'm ready to go, I just go. Well, he had his Zodiac tied behind his boat. It was half sunken, and his cockpit had about 25 empty rum bottles in it. He hadn't gone anywhere in a long time, but he had the philosophy that he was going to go when he was ready to go, and he wasn't going to look at a forecast. But most people, all smart people, are checking the forecasts, which are absolutely fantastic, and the science that goes into those forecasts is truly amazing.
Now you know why those guys are all single, too.
Exactly.
More than 60 winds are named. You mentioned that in your book, that they're consistent enough that they occur on at least a somewhat regular enough basis that they are named. Some may be familiar to people, the Santa Ana winds, for example, in California. Talk about some of the others and their importance, and do you have favorites?
Well, the Chinook, we all know Chinook winds in this part of the country. But I think my favorites, and it's not a named wind in the same way as a Santa Ana, but the trade winds. Mm-hmm. You know, as a sailor and just as a person who likes to read history, I spent, especially before this voyage, I spent an awful lot of time hearing about the trade winds and never really knowing what the trade winds are. But and some of your listeners will know what the trade winds are. I suspect all of the listeners have heard of trade winds. But trade winds are winds that blow, the so-called northeast trades, that blow around the latitude of Cuba, so just south of Florida, reasonably reliably blowing from Europe toward North America. So these are the winds that carried Columbus and various traders and et cetera, from Europe to the New World. And that is an easy sail because of those trade winds. And one of the themes in Roaring Wind, in my book, one of the themes was that we set out from Texas understanding that we would pretty quickly intercept these trade winds, and after that everything would be fine. Well, it turns out that the trade winds are very reliable offshore out in the Atlantic, but less so along the coast of Mexico or even in the Gulf of Mexico because of the land effect, because of things like northers that rip down the middle of the continent, rip down through the middle of the United States and cross the Gulf and can find their way all the way south to, well into Honduras on the severe northers that totally change the character of the trade winds. So the trade winds are definitely my favorite named wind, especially when they're working for you as they're supposed to. But one of the interesting parts of it to me was discovering that, hey, these trade winds that are billed as being so reliable. The Tradewind PR department tells you how these things just blow steady and never stop, and they're going to be there for you. And boy, that's just not really true in our experience in the coastal waters where we were sailing.
Mm-hmm. Lisanna, any favorites of yours, or are the Tradewinds at the top of the list?
Well, they certainly would be if we get to the offshore area where they are more reliable. I'm not sure if my favorite wind is named. It's probably the Goldilocks wind, where you can go beam reach or broad reach. And, you know, some people refer that to like champagne cruises where you're sailing really comfortably. We've had some of those, although mostly the way we've planned our trips is that we're sailing into the wind or almost into the wind. So we've tried to be smarter about that and looking at weather forecasts and trying to take our time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we ever planned to sail into the wind. It's just that it always seems to work out that way. So on a sailboat, on the top of the mast, there's a little arrow that points the wind direction, and it's sometimes called a windex. And there's a joke in the cruising community that just look at the windex, that tells you which direction you want to go. Because, of course, on a sailboat, it's very hard to sail directly into the wind. You have to sail sideways to the wind and zig and zag to get upwind.
Right. So. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and my guests today in the studio are author Bill Strever and his co-captain and wife, Lisanna. Bill is the author of 3 books, and the latest is just out, And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind. It is an examination of all things about the natural history of moving air. Do you feel like, now that you've written this really amazing examination of everybody who's sort of looked at and tried to understand wind through the ages, I should give out the numbers again. Excuse me. 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation. 1-800-478-TALK in the Anchorage area, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, if you have a question or a story that you'd like to share about the wind. Do you feel like you have a truly pretty good understanding of it now, or is trying to understand the wind sort of like trying to grab a hold of it, and it's just never something that can truly be understood?
Oh, I think I understand the wind. Well, let's put it this way. From where I was before I started writing this book to where I am now, a huge, huge difference. And I'd like to think the same thing for readers, that someone reading this book will begin with an understanding much like what I had as a normal person, maybe with an interest in sailing, maybe not. But everybody experiences wind, and we all watch it or look at weather forecasts and that kind of thing. So we think we have some knowledge of the wind. But for me, in writing this book, I realized that when I started, I knew essentially nothing about the wind. And when I finished, do I truly understand the wind? I don't know. I guess that would depend on what you mean by that. I'm not a trained meteorologist. I'm not a mathematical meteorologist. And most forecasts today all real forecasts today are based on mathematical models. So I'm not that person. But, I understand the wind way better than I did when I started writing this book. And I also feel like I understand forecasts much better than I did when I started this book. And a friend of mine asked me, he's a friend of mine who lives in Europe, and he just recently bought a sailboat, and he said, so is reading your book going to make me a better sailor? And I said, well, maybe, but mostly it's going to make you a more interesting sailor. and I mean that, because a lot of this is not so much, I mean, you could look at weather forecasts without ever understanding the science or the history behind it, and you can use those weather forecasts constructively in your day-to-day life, whether you're a sailor or a fisherman or a farmer or just somebody planning a vacation. You don't need all this additional information about where those forecasts come from and the huge history behind the forecasts and how wind and weather have affected, landscapes, history, et cetera. But it will make you a more interesting, more rounded person. It might even give you something to talk about at the next cocktail party.
And maybe the way that I phrased that question wasn't the best. Understanding the wind, maybe it's just more understanding how the variability that's built into how it can change and how, as you said, weather predictions, wind predictions can be quite accurate for a few days, but going out past that, not so much. And at one time, people thought that it would be just an issue of simple mathematics, that you would be able to predict the weather, the wind, because there wasn't a good understanding of sort of the chaos that's in the system and can change things. And so does it seem like the more you know, the more you realize that no matter how much you study and know it, there's a lot that just simply can't be pinned down?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. And, you know, the whole issue of mathematical forecasting and chaos theory, and people sometimes mistake chaos theory for the conventional use of the word chaos, or they've heard of chaos theory from, I think it was Jurassic Park, where it was sort of misrepresented of what chaos theory really is. But if I can have 2 minutes to waffle on with a quick briefing of weather forecasting history, I'll
please
do
that. Please do.
Okay. So around 1904, there was a Norwegian fellow named Wilhelm Bjerknes, and Bjerknes realized that the atmosphere should follow the rules of physics. And if it followed the rules of physics, it should be predictable mathematically. And he even laid out some very basic guidelines on how you would do that. But he said, but wait a minute, this is too hard, not because the individual equations were particularly difficult, but because they would have to be run and run and run and rerun and rerun in order to move a forecast forward. And then comes along another person, Lewis Fry Richardson. And Richardson knew of Bjerknes' work, and he said, well, I don't actually think it's that hard. And he worked with his wife, who was also a mathematician, and they actually started running some of these calculations. And the way it worked was they basically put a grid around the Earth, or a grid around part of the Earth, and it was a three-dimensional grid, like a three-dimensional chessboard. So it was a layered grid. And in each cell of that grid, they would have some initial data from weather reports from around the area. And they would have equations, and they would run those equations, and they, if I remember right, they ran the equations in six-hour intervals. So they would say, okay, the weather in 6 hours in this cell is going to be such and such. And then they would use that to as input for the cells around it and progress this thing ahead
forward.
six hours at a time, to develop a forecast. And the mathematics for any normal person, I would say, is pretty difficult, but Richardson said, this math is simple, it's just repetitive. And then along came World War I, and Richardson, who was a Quaker pacifist, volunteered to drive an ambulance on the front lines, wound up doing a lot of the calculations within earshot of artillery, in between ambulance runs and gas attacks, and et cetera, et cetera. So really an interesting story about how he did this. At the end of the war, he comes out with this manuscript, publishes it. The forecast that he made was just an outrageous forecast, and he knew that. He knew the forecast was not correct, could not be correct. It was the kind of forecast weather that really just doesn't occur. But he did say, you know, in principle, this should work. But you'll never have enough people to really run enough calculations to make it make sense, and et cetera. So
sure.
Flash forward to 1950, one of the very first programmable computers, ENIAC, that was designed. Ironically, in my opinion, they were taking this pacifist work, Lewis Fry Richardson, and putting it into a computer that was actually designed
assist
military purposes,
sure.
Hydrogen bomb development and shell trajectories. But they used it for a few days to do a numerical weather forecast, and it did work. And from there, it went into the research arena. And by around 1970 or so, was actually being the mathematical forecasts were replacing qualitative forecasts. So people my age, and I'm in my mid-50s, so people my age, we would have been accustomed as children to see forecasts that were based entirely on qualitative opinions, people looking at maps and saying, well, it looks like this is going to happen and that's going to happen, to mathematical projections of the weather, which is how weather is forecast today, using computers that are running trillions of operations per second, trillions of operations per second, with tremendous amounts of data coming in from all over the planet to form the foundation of those calculations.
Looking at all those cells. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Thomas is in Anchorage. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, let me get here. Well, I just wanted to say the first part sounded really cool. I being radio, you pictured in your mind sailing on the calm seas and seeing the whole world. And anyway, I like to watch the winds as opposed to be in them. And I got a cool address, so get your browsers ready. It's earth.nullschool.net. And there might be a slight delay, but when you hear the storms just raging down your valley, you can whip out your browser and you can see how many miles per hour it's actually blowing. And what I like to do with it is I'm paranoid about the rain from Fukushima area, and it's got rewind. And so I can go back and look at this storm that's hitting me now and rewind it and see, did it go over Japan? And that tells me maybe the rain's going to be radioactive. And so that's what I like to use it for. But it's really cool. You can see the winds everywhere, and it's awesome fun.
All right.
Well, earth.nullschool.net.
All right.
Yeah, have fun with that. You can see the winds as they roar.
That's great.
Thanks, Thomas.
That's great. And there's other online resources that let you see the wind. There's an animated map of wind across North America that's fun to look at. But it also works both ways. You know, the people that forecast weather and that try to understand weather, they're data hungry. They're very data hungry. They want to get input from every place they can. And I mentioned earlier airplanes. And, of course, we know about weather balloons and satellites and shipborne weather reporting. But a few years ago, an organization started gathering weather data, particularly barometric pressures, from people's cell phones. So you can sign up to the service. Lots of the smartphones actually have a barometric pressure ability to read barometric pressure, and you can sign up to the service, and your cell phone will be downloading into the weather matrix that's used at one of the universities.
Oh, that is very cool. I'm going to have to research that a little bit. I really like that idea. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Daniel is in Chivac. Hi, Daniel.
Howdy. I'm calling from Chivac, and it was in a little explanation of my observations that occur here with the wind. You see, Chivac is right smack dab in the middle of the Yukon and Kuskokwim River. We're basically in the middle of the delta here. And there's mountains about 15 to 17 miles north of Chivac. And a few miles after that is Scammon Bay. There's this one time in winter where we were traveling up to Scammon Bay to play basketball, and we were heading, and we were, on our way over, we were having, 25 to 30 knot winds. And as soon as we go over the mountain into Scammon Bay, there are smokestack chimneys, there's smokes going straight up. And I wanted to explain that phenomena where one side of the mountain is very windy. You go on the other side and it's calm. I find that intriguing. I thought I wanted to share that with you since you were explaining winds. That's my comment. All right.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Daniel. That is interesting. Bill, thoughts about what might be happening there?
So I don't know if Daniel's still on the phone. Was the wind on his way into the mountain coming towards him or away from him? Did you catch that?
He dropped off.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of different ways that could be explained, and probably a local weather service meteorologist could do a way better job than I could. A meteorologist. But wind does strange things, you know. I mean, many people have seen footage of areas that have been hit by a hurricane or tornado, and one house will be flattened, and next door, not only will there be a house that's still standing, but there will be things left on the picnic table that didn't get swept away.
Mm.
So wind does very strange things, and mountains certainly act as buffers, as do buildings that block wind on one side and accelerate winds on the other side.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the erratic nature of winds, especially tornadoes and some of the big blows that have done strange things. When we come back after a short break, we will be discussing "And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind" with author Bill Strever and his wife, Lisanna, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Sea of Air. I loved it when you talked about that. And describe what you mean by the Sea of Air, as Portugal the Man was just singing about.
Well, I love that song. I haven't heard that song before, but I need to get the whole thing. The Sea of Air. So the first time that I know of that phrase was used, we live at the bottom of a sea of air, of an ocean of air, was from one of the people involved in the early development of the barometer. So this goes back 400 years, about 400 years. And people realize that there is this thing called air, which wasn't necessarily, intuitive to people hundreds of years ago. They didn't necessarily think of air as a substance. I think it was Aristotle who said something to the effect that wind can't possibly just be moving air, or something like that. So people thought about the world very differently back then than we do today.
Aristotle.
So the sea of air concept came about when people started thinking of the weight of air, and they started thinking about the ocean. And, of course, both the ocean and the atmosphere are fluids, and they have some things in common and other things that are not in common at all, even though they're both fluids.
So when you're out in your boat, you're at the bottom of one sea and then on the top of another.
That's exactly how I think about it. And not only that, but the two are interacting. So, hurricanes in particular are the result of an interaction between warm ocean temperatures and the atmosphere. And it generates tremendous wind energies, as we all know. But those two fluids that you're in, they're interacting all the time and affecting weather. And some of the mathematical weather models that are out there, in fact, I think most of the sophisticated ones now incorporate data about the sea as well as about the atmosphere.
If you're just joining us, you're late. It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking with author Bill Strever about his book, And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind. It's a natural history of moving air. Our numbers, if you'd like to join us, are 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK, or locally in Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Bruce is in Fairbanks. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, good morning, and I had 3 points, and then I want to tell three little stories, but I want to tip my hat to the forecasters. I plowed snow up here in Fairbanks for a long time, and I think they're very good. Sometimes they're a little bit off, sometimes it's sooner or later, but I think the forecasting is great, and I'd like you guys to talk about how wind is created by fire, so to speak. And then I want to know if you know about the book Coming Back Alive, the big storm. I think it was out of Sitka, where a fishing boat sank, and it's about three helicopters going up trying to get these guys. Are you familiar with that book?
I'm not. I'm afraid it sounds like a great book, though.
It's a fantastic book. It's, a big storm, and this one guy on the boat saw it coming, and they said, we need to go, and the captain didn't want to, and the result was sinking, and it might have sunk anyway. But with regard to wind, specifically, we were awakened one night years ago, and I think it was winter or fall or something, by this tremendous wind, but it wasn't a scary wind. It seemed like a very friendly wind, and we went outside and just watched this wind blow through, and it lasted about 10 minutes, and then it was gone. And it was just one of the strangest things. It didn't seem threatening like some winds can be. There was no rain with it. Just this puff for 10 minutes, and then it was gone. And I thought that was a really strange event. And the other thing I wanted to mention is I have a shop and an ATCO unit outside of town just a bit, and they are oriented east-west, and they're about 10 or 12 feet apart. And I get a wind tunnel in there. There are other areas of the land there, not so much. But you could be away from the shop and then walk into that little tunnel there, and there's a tremendous amount of wind, if there's wind at all. And it just seems to want to collect or something in there. And the other thing I'd like to mention is this storm out at Chena Lakes, recreational lakes outside of Fairbanks. They used to rent these little Hobie cats out there. And I'm not a sailor. Have time in the Coast Guard, but it was under power, not sail. And my wife and nephew and daughter, those guys were pretty small. The kids were pretty small at the time. We're on this Hobie cat having a nice time. The kids were in the water. And I looked out towards Eielson, and I saw this big black wall. I don't know how high, I couldn't measure, but maybe it was a half a mile high or something. And I said, kids, get in the boat. We got to go. And they got in the boat, and that wind hit us and blew us back to the docks. I don't know how I made it back without dumping the boat, or we just happened to be sailing in the direction of the wind, I guess. Mm. And right before we hit the docks, we dropped the sail and just glided in there like I'd been sailing all my life. It was pretty amazing. But I think the wind is tremendously fascinating and dangerous sometimes. But I think the idea of writing a book about it is wonderful. I want to get it and read it.
That's good news.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Bruce. We have another question from Fairbanks by email. Tom McGrain writes, Fairbanks is not known for being very windy, especially compared to Healy and Delta Junction. He says, but the last few years, it seems like we have had a lot more wind. Are wind patterns changing significantly, perhaps from climate change, or are there long-term changes that happen over decades? But I mean, climate change is happening over decades as well, so.
And who was that question from?
Tom McGrain. Tom in Fairbanks.
Well, so first I want to go back to Bruce for just a second.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And he said lots of things, and that was great, Bruce. Thanks for calling in. But one thing you mentioned was hats off to forecasters, and absolutely hats off to forecasters. I don't think most people realize just how much goes into a forecast and the amazing science that's being done in operational forecast, just day-to-day routine application of science, but also ongoing research to improve those forecasts.
And save lives.
And save lives, save money. It's a very cost-effective use of science, and most people don't realize that the money invested in improving forecasts pays off in huge multiples. It's a wonderful investment for society to improve forecasting abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, Tom was asking about the winds in Fairbanks, and you're right, Tom, winds in Fairbanks, and I had this confirmed just recently, yesterday, I think, talking to one of the meteorologists based in Fairbanks. Fairbanks is shielded from the winds. So on three sides, Fairbanks is shielded from most of the prevailing wind, and yet right down the road in Delta Junction, you have one of the windiest places in the state, where instead of being shielded, wind is funneled through, just as it was funneled between the Connex boxes that we heard about from Bruce. So yeah, it is generally protected in the Fairbanks area. But you do hear anecdotally people saying, you know, the past few years it's been windier. And you often hear the same question that we just heard, is that climate change or not? And I think the climate change scientists, I think if you look in the literature for climate change science and wind, what you're going to find is that people are very undecided about how climate change is affecting wind. And, you know, one answer is that there's more energy in the system, there's more heat in the system, so you would expect stronger winds. But mm-hmm. but another answer is that one of the fundamental drivers of winds on the planet is the difference in temperature between the tropics and the polar regions. And the polar regions are warming up quicker than the tropics, quicker than the temperate zones. So that temperature differential is decreasing. So you would say, well, all else being equal, you would expect winds to be less strong due to climate change. But all things are not equal. And really what's going on locally is very hard to get a handle on, and even harder to know if it should be attributed to climate change or something else, because all kinds of other things are changing at the same time. And there's just natural background variability. So that was a very long-winded way of saying, Tom, I don't know.
All right. We're talking about Bill Strever's new book, And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or locally in Anchorage, 550-8422. This is a question maybe Lisanna could weigh in on. Knowing what you do know now about wind and weather, would you recommend that people take a 3-day sailing course and then head out into the open sea? When I was reading about that, I was thinking about people who take a few hours of diving instruction and then put on scuba gear and head down, which I think is folly. So, Lisanna, knowing what you know now about being out on the ocean, did you feel well enough prepared when you left?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think that not knowing something might help you because you're braver, because you don't know, you know, what you're fighting against.
Sure.
So, but there is, of course, a fine line, because if you're completely, you know, not prepared, then you should definitely not go out, because if I look back, I think, and we've talked, Bill and I've talked about it before, and, you know, kind of reflecting on what we did, was it smart? And both of us look at each other and then say, like, well, we probably would not do the same thing if we would have to make the same decision. Of course, because we're now smarter and we know better what we can expect out in the open ocean, and you should be prepared. So I don't know, a 3-day sailing course in Seward might not prepare you for crossing an ocean. On the other hand, it's the same cookbook analogy that you took. I mean, at some point you have to start getting experience somewhere. So
yes. Well, and also I think that it's important to note that you're both scientists. So it's not as if you were just a couple of wide-eyed kids that went and jumped on a boat and took off. I'm sure that you did a lot of other research, as well as just, it wasn't just a 3-day sailing course.
We're both scientists, so we're wide-eyed, middle-aged people. but I'll be the responsible adult here and say that, look, taking a 3-day sailing course that's not in any way intended to prepare you to sail offshore, because the 3-day sailing course is an introduction to sailing, and there's other courses. It's not smart to jump on a boat and cross an ocean with 3 days of sailing training behind you. That's not a smart thing to do. It's not recommended. Yeah, we'd hate to leave listeners thinking that you should do something like this. There's better ways to approach your first ocean crossing.
Well, I want to go back to the phones in a moment here, but I keep thinking about what one of the callers said, and forgive me, I've forgotten who said this, about fires and wind. And it reminded me of James Espy, who President Adams called the monomaniac, James Espy. I loved that. Mm-hmm. And he thought that you could light forest fires to control storms, and they're by the wind. I think the president said his ego was bigger than a goiter, which I also really mm-hmm. got a kick out of. So what was he trying to get at there with fires and controlling weather?
Yeah, I think that was Bruce that mentioned fires and weather.
Thank you.
In SB, people called him the Storm King. He might have even called himself the Storm King, and he definitely had a storm-sized ego. But so fires generate heat. We all know that. And if you've seen fires, people can talk about some fires creating their own weather. And what those fires are really doing is sucking in air from around them at the ground level and pushing that air upward into the atmosphere. And Espy thought that you could strategically set forest fires to change moisture regimes and wind regimes enough to affect local weather.
Hmm. Interesting concept, but I can't imagine the size of the fire you would have to try to undertake to have that kind of influence on the weather. Let's go back to the phones. Kenneth is in Anchorage. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi.
You have a comment about goat weather?
Well, some decades ago, I lived in Oregon, and there was a radio station that gave the weather report, but somebody got to noticing on the mountain behind the station, in fair weather, the goats would be up high on the mountain, in semi-cloudy, they'd be midway, and in stormy, they'd be down in the valley, so they started following the weather report with the goat report. And they kept track of this, and the goats were more accurate.
That's amazing.
That's my comment.
We'll watch for the goat report.
So scientists have to kind of hand it to the goats, I guess.
I guess they do.
But there is a huge tradition of weather forecasting by animals, and there's some great stories out there about that. One of my favorites is from a spy who was working for Napoleon. He was in Holland, and he was watching a spider, and somehow the spider's behavior told him that they would expect a cold winter. He relayed that information to the French military, and the French military planned their invasion so they could march across the frozen Dutch landscape without getting mired down in the swamps and rivers that characterize the Netherlands.
Hmm. All right, we're going to go back to the phones. Denny is in Anchorage. Hi, Denny.
Hi, this is Denny, and hello, Bill and Lisanne. This is Denny. It's great to hear you on the radio and hear that you're doing well with your boat. I had a comment about wind, and actually quite a nice play off of what you're just talking about, how it affects the behavior of animals and also people who pursue them. When I'm out hunting, wind is great both to cover my sound and to help me decide how to approach the animal that I'm hunting, but I curse it when it's cold out and I'm freezing and the wind's blowing and I can't sit there any longer because of the dang wind. And it applies in fishing as well, because I appreciate the breezes blowing the bugs into the water and creating a little bit of non-clarity in the water column. But I curse it when I'm trying to canoe across the lake or when I'm trying to make a back cast when I'm fly fishing. So just very practical applications of wind, and I can't wait to read the book.
All right. Thanks for the call, Denny. We had a listener that sent in an email saying, I recently read a book, The Wave. Its author was writing about the increase in rogue waves due to climate change. And the request is, can you talk some more about how bodies of water are responding to increased wind due to climate change? Is there increased wind due to climate change?
There's increased effects of wind for certain due to climate change in the Beaufort Sea. And there what we're talking about is the loss of sea ice. It's well known. We can all look at satellite images and see that the pack ice is retreating further than it used to, and et cetera. So there's more open water, so there's less friction. So the wind at the ground level, normally wind at ground level is being tripped by friction with the ground. So the wind at the ground level is never representative of what's 20 or 30 feet higher up. And the same's true with sea ice that's tripping the wind. And so you have wind crossing those larger bodies of open water in the Beaufort Sea, and definitely bigger waves, more storm damage on the coast.
Let's take one more call before we have to take a quick break here. Nancy is in Kenai. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. Yes, my comment was kind of an educational thing. I used to have a friend who taught in the Arctic, and one summer I was visiting her, and every August she had to go to an orientation in Anchorage with the school districts from the Arctic before they were allowed to go out there, and they were handed a pamphlet of all these native skills that they were ordered to include into their curriculum because they were so vital to the students. And she taught elementary school. And the one that stuck in me, I mean, this is like 40 pages of stuff. The one that really stuck in my craw was the children were taught that if they were out playing on the tundra and a storm came up and they got lost in the wintertime, to carefully brush the snow back away from the ground to where they could see what pattern the grass was laying and use the grass as a compass, because if the west was the prevailing wind and if the grass was laying to the east, they could tell very quickly where the west was and head for the coast.
Wow.
What a great tip. That's probably true in many areas.
And that just took me totally aback, and it just stuck in the back of my mind. I wish we had more places where weather could be such an accurate thing. But I know you were talking about the Beaufort Sea. I know my son used to work up there, and the elders used to just to be able to look at the sky, even a clear sky, and look at the wind and faint patterns, and they could judge the weather and stop people from going out, and they can't do that anymore. They're so confused trying to predict the weather.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Nancy, for the call and that interesting tidbit about how to find your way home lost in a storm. Wow, that was really interesting. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking more with Bill Strever and Lisanna about "And Soon I Heard a Roaring Wind."
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your experiences out at sea. One of the things that you talked about was whistling up a wind in the horse latitudes. Lisanna would not whistle with you. Tell us about that. Why are the winds kind of wimpy there? And how did the name come about, the horse latitudes?
Well, so the winds are wimpy because of atmospheric patterns. And I won't get into it now just for the sake of time. But the horse latitudes, you know, many people are under the mistaken impression that in the days of sail, people would be getting to that area, they'd be calm, they'd be running out of water, so they'd throw their horses overboard so that they wouldn't have to water the horses. And that, as far as I can tell, isn't the right answer of why the horse latitudes. It has more to do with a sort of a celebration that the sailors had. They were often paid in advance for the first period of the voyage, and they spent all that money before they sailed, and they wouldn't start making money again until roughly the time they reached the horse latitudes. And they had a celebration that they would do with a straw horse. You know, back in the days of sail, I think first of all, there was an awful lot of alcohol on those boats. And secondly, I think it was pretty tedious work because they would spend months and months at sea. And they would have celebrations for crossing the equator and for reaching horse latitudes and things like that.
A little too much time on their hands so they could build a straw horse to...
Exactly.
To beat up on the deck.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take one more call. Bob is in Anchorage. Bob, can you give us a comment or a question quickly, please?
This is Bob. I'm glad Bill has written this book, and also glad to know that he's addressed the issue of the transition from the qualitative observations and forecasts that I lived with in the 80s and 90s out in the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea, and the quantitative that we see on these days. I saw when they laid off or gave early outs for many of the forecasters in the Weather Service office, the storm forecast changed. And when you're a mariner, under forecasting a storm is never a good thing. So any comments, Bill?
I think lots and lots of people would agree. In the very early days of forecasting, when the person who was the captain of the Beagle, who was, of course, the boat that took Darwin across the oceans, but he was involved with the very early official weather forecasts and storm warnings, and there was a lot of debate at that time of under-forecasting or over-forecasting storm warnings. And ship captains who were angry because his storm warnings were keeping their boats in port, and they felt like they were losing money. They'd rather have their boats at sea despite the risks. So it's a long debate, goes back over 150 years to Captain Fitzroy, over forecast or under forecast.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
Thanks for the call, Bob. When we first started the program, there was a mention of Goldilocks winds. Can the two of you kind of describe what that means, what that is? And then I have a follow-up question from that.
Well, I don't remember if I made up the term or read it somewhere else, but the Goldilocks wind is it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. That's the wind you're looking for. And Lasana would always talk about champagne cruises in the morning. We don't drink when we're underway, but unlike the old time sailors. But sometimes we'd have a champagne cruise in the morning, and by the afternoon we're at least mentally, we're afraid for our lives, although I don't think our lives were really in jeopardy too often. But I noticed earlier in the show, Lasan picked up on my Goldilocks winds term, so maybe I was using that a lot on the boat.
It's a great way to describe a nice, the kind of wind that you would want, for sure.
It's not the wind that occurs a lot, that's for sure.
The elusive Goldilocks winds. In some of your adventures, you had at least one close call with a tanker. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what can I say? You know, you're out there, you're sailing. I think our longest at sea passage was about 10 days. And we're a shorthanded crew. It's just the two of us, and we take shifts. I was tired and got confused in the middle of the night about the direction a tanker was going, and we came way closer than I would have liked to a collision. And of course, a tanker versus sailboat, guess who's going to win?
Yeah.
The closer call we had, we were actually at anchor. And lots of ships and sailboats of all descriptions have been lost while at anchor because of windstorms that either drug their anchors, as it did in our case, and threw the ship or boat onto rocks or onto shore and pounded it to death, or because anchor chains occasionally break.
We only have a few seconds left. I can't believe we're at the end of the hour, and I have so much more I wanted to ask. But what's next for the two of you, both adventure-wise and writing-wise?
Well, in the near term, we're going to spend a few weeks on the Yukon River here coming up soon, we hope, weather allowing. And in the longer term, we are what we consider to be at the front end of a circumnavigation that we hope will take at least 10 years. So a very slow circling of the Earth, hopefully with very few negative encounters with the wind.
All right. And we'll look forward to whatever your next writing project is going to be very soon. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Wesley Early on the phones. I'm Lori Townsend.
Made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.